know you. You love teaching on lab day because science lives there. In the problem solving and the teamwork and all the hustle and bustle of sorting something out. But maybe you've fallen victim to this notion that you can't lead a lesson like that every day because it requires expensive equipment or a stocked supply closet.
Well, in this episode,
I'm going to shed some light on what active learning is really all about, why it's perfectly suited for our science classrooms, but how it's different from the status quo you're used to, and give you some very specific and popular strategy options you have for making it happen every day for you and your students. Plus, I'll show you around some of my very own activities from my chemistry classroom where I deliver these active learning experiences every day using free technology resources as the muse. If this is our first time meeting, I'm Lisa. I'm here to support secondary science teachers and convince them to lock away their lecture notes and instead opt for meaningful moments, creating meaningful moments that will lead to true lasting learning. Now, if you do a quick search for active learning on Google, you'll get a few different results. A few of those results might actually suggest to you that active learning has to be physically active. Like, you'll be able to see web pages and videos of teachers and students who are marching and gesturing and singing out science content. That's not what we're talking about here. Another form of active learning seems to be used in higher ed, and especially it seems in medical school. And it refers more to students taking ownership of the learning process, and the active part is them like transcribing notes from a textbook or in some other way making it real for themselves. We're not talking about that either. Most of the references you're going to find to active learning refer to a whole pedagogy, a whole approach called constructivism. Now that's a big word. Constructivism is about making new knowledge. It's about that highest tier in that super famous taxonomy you learned in college. Constructivism is a big word that means nothing more than putting together your experiences to learn something new. Literally creating new knowledge. But typically, it's coming from firsthand experience. It's coming from explorations or it's coming from discovery. It's the kind of learning we did when we were itty bitty kids, when we learned to walk and talk, when we learned that a campfire is hot and snowflakes are cold and wet. Even as adults, we're learning new things this way. In the comments below, tell me, what was the last thing you learned that you couldn't possibly have learned without doing it, without firsthand account of trying and maybe even failing? For me, it was sewing. I didn't try to sew until maybe 2 years ago when I got a machine so that I could DIY some curtains. And at that time, I needed all the instruction. I needed to be shown, I needed to be told, and I needed my hands on the thing. And you know what? I need to go through all those motions every single time I pull out the machine because I do it so rarely. So that's for another video, but just saying there, planting that seed of consistency for you. So why is active learning perfectly suited for science? Well, before I go there, let me just remind you that I do teach high school. And so when I try to think about some other subjects where it might apply, some obvious ones come up. Music. Absolutely, if you're trying to learn to play an instrument, you need to play the instrument. thinking about woodshop, my oldest son this year is starting his first woodshop class. And that's another thing, like nobody's just gonna talk you through using a bandsaw. You have to actually get your hands on it and know what it feels like and, you know, what it's like to turn and twist and all the things, right? Gym class is obvious. You're very active in gym class. So why science? Well, I don't think in literature or in history, you don't really have an opportunity. It's not natural to the content for you to have to do something with it other than, you know, write and recount history. in science, it's really rare that you would find a science program that doesn't have some sort of lab component attached to it. Even if you're in the middle school, even if you teach elementary school, you are carving out some time for students to explore and to apply those scientific principles. And these lab days, we all know the benefits, right? They are active. Students don't sit in their chairs, and if they are sitting in their chairs, they're not expected to be quiet. And students kind of know. It's sort of like when they have a substitute, you know? They know they got some latitude, some room to stretch their wings, if you will. Active learning also totally complements the scientific method. I mean, if constructivism is about making new knowledge, and that traditional scientific method, the process of going through science that scientists use all the time, is to do verbs. They explore, they observe, they write notes, and they think about stuff, and they do math related to the stuff, and they come back to a conclusion. Science should be collaborative. And active learning is often also collaborative in its best self, in its best form. Scientists in labs around the world don't work by themselves. There might be a few, okay? And certainly we credit the individuals like Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein for amazing discoveries, but modern day science is teams of people where sometimes on those teams, individuals own a part of the process. And on other teams, they all own parts of the process, and it's the collaboration and the exposure to new ideas and perspectives that propels their understanding forward. Science, of course, develops higher order thinking skills because inherent to the process of science is reflection and analysis and inferencing or conclusion driving. Now, active learning also sets the stage for students to own the process because it is not passive. It's the very antithesis of passivity. Students are no longer listening and soaking up information and trying to just get it to, you know, transverse their skull. They're actually doing something with it. It in and of itself is empowering. So students with consistency applied to this sort of student-centered culture, students are able to learn and that they can and learn how to set their own goals, to measure their progress against those goals, and to decide what to do next to get toward or closer to that goal or maybe make another goal. But maybe you're out there and you're thinking, all of those things don't happen on my lab day. Maybe I really don't even have active learning on lab day. And so I want to also pay homage to the fact here that active learning isn't really super prevalent. You probably were not a student of active learning in science. You probably never saw anybody do it, and certainly no one ever taught you to make it happen in your classroom. We came up in this system of lecture and then lab. We spend the predominance of our time telling students everything we know. We're treating science as a collection of facts. And actually, the subliminal message there is kind of telling the students, you just have to know it because there was nothing you could do to get there yourself. If we're not telling them what we know, we're modeling it for them, you know? Maybe we're putting up a picture on the board and asking a bunch of really deep thinking questions, or maybe we're modeling processes. You know, like in my chemistry classroom, I'm thinking of when we have to problem solve things like identifying charge in an ion, or naming a compound, or writing the products from a chemical reaction. We do have to spend some time showing them how it all comes together. And so we can get really wrapped up in that. Sometimes we think we're doing a great thing by doing flashy demonstrations. There was a professor at Penn State University when I was there for my graduate degree who put on a huge Halloween show. And who knows, maybe if you're watching, you even saw it. And it was in a big lecture hall, and it had huge flames and this heavy metal music, and it was, kids loved it. And if you do cool stuff, you're creating that interest, you're inspiring something there, but there's really no connection to knowledge. It's just awe inspiring. So we got halfway there. What we're really talking about here with active learning and constructivism is moving toward a learner-centered or student-centered approach. Take a look at this side-by-side comparison of learner-centered approaches versus teacher-centered approaches. First, we have the obvious. Active participation in a learner-centered approach and passive reception of information in a teacher-centered approach. This is what I'm calling lecture versus lab. Students are involved or they're just listening. You know, I often might add the tagline, turn your students into active learners instead of active listeners. We often are told to use body language and visual cues to know if a student is plugged in with us. Certainly eye contact is one of them. But active listening and active learning are wildly different, and they look wildly different. Then we have knowledge construction through personal experience on the student-centered side and knowledge transmission from teacher to student on the teacher-centered side. Again, it's passive. Teacher's throwing that football. Student gets really good. By the time they get in high school, they're really good at catching that ball. Or maybe they've just decided they're not whatever that position is in football where they catch the ball. The running back? I don't know. The receiver. Probably the receiver. In learner-centered approaches, we have student interactions with one another. And in teacher-centered approaches, there's no opportunity because all the time is spent with the teacher talking at the student. Critical thinking and problem solving abounds with the learner-centered approach because what they're doing constantly is trying to sort out for themselves what all is going on in the system or the problem or the scenario. Whereas in a teacher-centered approach, it's definitely an emphasis on memorization. And you might hate to have to accept that you're part of that. My guess, if you're still watching my videos, you hate that. And I hated that. So we are compadres here, okay? Meaning over memorization. That's my thing. So let's just put on the left-hand side, instead of critical thinking and problem solving, let's just call it meaning. We get meaning and we have meaningful time spent. We have meaningful interactions and we have meaningful participation, not just to check off the box for the day. On the student-centered side, continuing on here, authentic and meaningful. Oh, I put the cart before the horse. It actually says meaningful and authentic, genuine, not fake. On the teacher-centered side, abstract, disconnected. Learner-centered includes reflection and metacognitive skills. This is what I was telling you about, or starting to sprinkle in this idea that students should be able to start to gauge where they are versus where they think they should be, or what their goals are and how far they've come toward those goals. To be able to look back on an experience and wonder, why did that happen? Hey, wait a minute, I have this prior life experience that I know completely conflicts with what I'm seeing here. And then you get students to ask questions. That's when science takes hold. Meanwhile, in the teacher-centered classroom, you got limited reflection and really not a lot of that ability to go back and self-correct. And on the learner-centered side, it supports individual differences and diverse learning needs. We're meeting students where they are because we have no other choice. We can see exactly where they are when we're giving them the opportunity to show us and not instead fit into some mold, this one-size-fits-all approach that you see listed here on the teacher-centered side. Okay, to recap all that, the status quo in science in general in the U.S. is to lecture and then lab. So we do sprinkle in some of this active learning. We have acknowledged that it's necessary, it's a thing, but we're still usually only doing the lab after the lecture. So really what we're doing is we're asking students to go see for yourself that everything I told you is the truth. Verify it. And usually, in whatever we're giving them to record their understanding on, whether it's a worksheet or a notebook, whatever you use, there is some component there that's asking them to tap into the lecture content. Not their experience so much, because we do want them to pull evidence from their experience. What was the color change? Did you see any solid? What color was the flame? I don't know. I only teach chemistry, okay? So this is why I'm here helping you all do this for yourselves, because I think there's a huge degree of content area expertise that's necessary. I can't even throw out any biology examples. Okay, we want them to use the evidence from the lab, but then we also want them to explain why it happened. It's totally not uncommon to see on a lab worksheet, explain why this happened. Because we're asking students to connect. And connection is amazing and wonderful. But we want students to connect for themselves. We want students to create what we've already told them about. We want them to connect their logic. We want them to connect through logic and through critical thinking. We don't want them to go, oh, well, last week I learned that blah, 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 blah. And so that's the answer. Because the other thing this does is it makes one right answer. And that's not science. In fact, I don't have the statistic on this, but as a scientist who worked in the lab, scientists are mostly wrong. Science is propelled by wrong answers, by partial discovery. What you don't finish, the next person will pick up and take. Or maybe you finish it, but along the way, somebody else picks it and takes it in another direction. So ideally, we'd want students to do all of it themselves, not still be leaning so much on us and our knowledge for them and theirs. I think it's also really important that we're honest with each other, and that as a community of science teachers, we do support each other authentically. So if you are teaching in that traditional status quo lecture lab model, give this video a like and come back eventually someday and see how many likes it has amassed, because my guess is it's going to be pretty large. So let's turn that chip around, shall we? Let's get you one step closer to locking away those lecture notes for good. That's always the goal here at Lab in every lesson. Here's a few approaches. Probably you're familiar with many of them. The first that we can talk about here is the problem-based learning approach. You might have seen this around called PBL. Whole staff positions in schools are focused and devoted to creating PBL curriculum. It is a tall order, in my opinion. Some of the criteria for problem-based learning include authentic and ill-structured problems. So we're not talking about something here that is stepwise and guided, but rather maybe a real life problem. In problem-based learning, students work collaboratively to analyze the problems, generate hypotheses, gather information, propose solutions, and evaluate their effectiveness. So in my summary there, problem-based learning is as close to real science practice in a real lab as a real scientist as we can possibly get. Then we have maybe a notch down in complexity and difficulty, I think, project-based learning. Now the criteria for project-based learning include complex, multifaceted tasks or projects over an extended period of time. So to be clear, project-based learning is not a lab that lasts a few days. Project-based learning is definitely up and coming as it pertains to STEM and STEAM-related curriculum, where our goal is to have students not just create new knowledge, but to create that knowledge while they create a solution to something. This type of design allows them to delve deeply into a topic, explore many different perspectives and apply their knowledge and skills in meaningful ways. Now, just because I didn't list collaboration there as one of the criteria doesn't mean it doesn't abound in project-based learning environments. I think it absolutely probably does, but it's not a necessity. Because by its very name, we want students to solve a problem, be presented with one. It probably really does lean more heavily on background research too, and really seeking out answers yourself from written text and maybe even interviews with people. So you get a really firm foundation of the facts before beginning to apply them and going through that whole then scientific method. Next up, we have collaborative learning. Collaborative learning is often defined as focusing on students' engagement in meaningful discussions, knowledge sharing, and the construction of knowledge through social interaction. It involves students working together in groups or teams to achieve shared learning goals, solve problems, complete tasks, or create something collectively. Considering that and reading through that and hearing that, I hear, isn't that also happening in problem-based learning? Isn't that also happening in project-based learning? Can students in those models really do it by themselves? I mean, in those models, usually students are really doing some heavy engineering tasks. A colleague of mine talks about when she was at in a former work environment in a different school, the students created like a heat pump, you know, like a heat source. And they had all the things to do to figure out how, you know, what to collect and what objects they needed and how much heat it was going to put out and all these things. I am absolutely sure that not many of them could do that start to finish themselves, and that there was a degree of collaboration involved. I think the difference here with collaborative learning as a standalone is that maybe it is better suited to, in the context or the realm of science, to a community and socially impact-driven focus. For example, I know that there are courses out there in high schools called Chemistry in the Community or Chemistry in Society. And they might talk about the atomic bomb and nuclear fusion, but they're not really talking about nuclear bombardment and the amount of energy that comes out at different phases and the penetration level or any of the minutiae. They're talking about the societal impact. Maybe they're debating and discussing, should we have nuclear power plants? Should we disarm the world of nuclear weapons? You know, so they're taking that science concept and now they're having discussions where other people's opinions might actually change their own. And as a matter of fact, science really isn't opinion-based, right? I mean, science is very driven by fact. Is it possible for us to have students debate an answer, an outcome, conclusion based on evidence and reasoning and get different answers? Yes. Yes, absolutely. But I just see this as a very different type of model. The other thing it really leans on is students teaching students. I mean, and that's where the opinion piece comes in. Because the social aspect of teaching and learning in a collaborative environment, it's all on the kiddos. It's all on the kiddos. It's the teacher's job simply to facilitate and to make sure there's growth and advancement and moving forward throughout the lesson or throughout the series to reach whatever those lesson goals are. But I truly don't think that, especially for NGSS purposes, we're really satisfying any of the performance indicators by relying solely on a collaborative model. I think that collaborative model piece has to be sprinkled into all of the others. Which brings me to our fourth and final, which is the inquiry-based model. Now, the inquiry-based model leans heavily on actively engaging students in asking questions, gathering information, conducting investigations, and constructing meaning through their own exploration. Does that sound like anything you've ever heard of before? There are some circles online where I have been chastised by a few people for referring to that as the scientific method. I truly don't know what y'all call it now, but it's science. You wonder about something. Whether you realize it or not, the question pops in your head and you dig deeper. You collect observations, information. You maybe organize it so that you can identify trends, so that you can come away with something new that's learned. So actually, I want to tell you this. I have done my own research. It hasn't been super deep because I didn't even want to waste time there. But I think that there is such a thing as a discovery model of learning that teachers use or that somebody created or proposed. And I think that those people classify it differently, or there is some distinction between discovery and inquiry-based. For me and my purposes, I find them to be exactly equal. Everything that you just saw and heard is science. It is science. And I think you're probably getting the vibe I'm sending out to you, that it's my favorite child in this constructivist pedagogy family. Yeah, I said it. Diving just a little bit deeper into each of those features of the model, questioning and observations. Questioning and observations are the heart and the start of every scientific process. And what's wonderful about inquiry-based is that we can add a level of structure and guidance to it that makes it suitable for each and every student. So project-based and problem-based, they definitely are much, much, much of a wider net that we would cast. They are curriculum and lessons that all contribute to a marking period long or a semester long or sometimes even a year long goal, a year long something that the students are getting to. In inquiry-based, we can do that thing we call chunking. You know, chunking is a way to differentiate. It's a way to provide accommodations. And because I work with a student population that is a little bit more needy and requires more support to get to those core ideas, I have to rely on that guidance that I'm able to provide. Quick story, because this is learning, right? Learning is life. When I very first created my own chemistry curriculum, it was within the first 10 lessons that I learned a lot of lessons. The biggest one being, with my unique student population, if I gave an activity that sounded like or felt like, here's a simulation, it has three buttons. Play with it. Tell me what you did to play with it, and tell me what you learned. And actually, it did have a little bit more guidance than that. I said, these are the definitions I want you to be able to extract from your experience. No go. And this one was probably like the very first time this happened. It was like the second or third lesson. Definitely inside of myself, I was like, this is not going to work for my students. But I am absolutely not the teacher who moves on despite the fact the kids didn't get it. So that night, I reworked the whole thing. I added in so much more support, because now this was like day two or three. And now I understand what they need. And I kind of went to the whole other side of the spectrum, being more clear about what they needed to do, and then leaning more heavily on once they get it all together, like we do in science. See what you can come away with. Because they couldn't do those executive tasks on their own. They didn't have it all together yet to do that. And this is something we can go for over a year. You know, just because my students can't do it on day one or two or 10 doesn't mean they can't do it on day 180. Experimental design is one of the tabs that you see behind me, experimental design domination. It is definitely a goal I always have in mind, but definitely not one I can achieve until the end of the year. Where maybe, just maybe, I can say, this is your muse. Play with it. Write down your notes and tell me what you learned. But throughout the process, I can differentiate for individual students, individual groups, individual lessons. The possibilities are limitless. And the reason I love it so much that I share it with you is because we're living in a nation right now with a woefully low average reading level. They don't report science levels. Our math isn't too good either. So it's my belief that's probably not the majority of the country of students who could just jump into problem and project-based learning and be successful.
Nope.
Another feature of inquiry-based learning models similar to your problem and project-based learning is real-life scenarios, real-world problems. And this fits in perfectly with our NGSS expectations of incorporating phenomenon, and having phenomenon-based lessons, and really driving that curiosity, turning the volume up in a big way. Citing evidence and analyzing all that evidence you collect is front and center, second only to questioning observations in this methodology. And so again, even though it happens in problem and project-based learning, here it is just super more focused. It removes a degree of overwhelm, and in my experience, gets you one step closer to achieving goals. Small goals, smart goals. Because the students have smaller, smarter goals, because they are given a degree of guidance, maybe specific to them or the whole group they're working with, I have found the propensity for collaboration with me to skyrocket with this kind of system. It seems like every student's afraid to say, Mrs. Carosis, I don't know where to begin. I have found when I give them that extra layer of support in the questioning, kind of pushing them toward where I want them to go, they're much more focused in their own questions to me about what they've done, in defending their responses or sharing what they see and wondering if it fits. And most of the time it does. They just doubt themselves. I think any diehard teacher that's using inquiry-based learning is going to suggest to you that students have to identify their own muse. Students have to come up with questions. Students have to create a plan for answering those questions, all the things. Okay. Yeah, maybe in my dream world. I mean, I don't know who I'm talking to out there, but that's not my world. But again, it has the possibility to be. You could still be in an inquiry-based model and give your students all the freedom. When I very, very first started selling my lessons on Teachers Pay Teachers, one fantastic, super awesome client of mine said, this seems a little simplistic for high school chem. And I work with honors students, so definitely too simple for them. And I suggested just the opposite. You know, I suggested that those, what we knew as honors chemistry was all about rote memorization. And yes, there's some problem-solving skills, but this is a whole new set of skills. It's an entirely new set of skills we're introducing, those science practice skills each and every day. And when we use the word differentiating, too many people think of dumbing it down. Yeah, I said that. Not enough of us think about going in the opposite direction. And guided inquiry provides that opportunity to differentiate, to adjust the guidance on two levels of continuum. One is complexity of thought, and the other is just basic amount of action, inquiry and action. Because there are some students who are just going to be overwhelmed by the amount that you ask them to do. Sometimes we want them to do less so that it can think deeper. And sometimes we want them to do more because it's not a complex concept. And the more data we collect, the easier it is to see the pattern. And so we can differentiate for individual lessons too. I mean, be still my heart, it's just my favorite. What I've really been sharing with you is kind of like flipping the idea of how we do science lab. Now, that's not to be mistaken with a flipped classroom. I'm not talking about flipping your classroom. And in fact, there's really no way for me to drive home this idea than to show you how I see active learning and how we can do it with consistency each and every day. Here's a few of my lessons. Now, this is obviously one of those times where watching the video is much preferred to listening to the podcast, but you do always have that option to hop on over to YouTube and give a watch there. The title is exactly the same. Now, before I get talking too much about them, I do want to add a little disclaimer here, and that is that so many of the free technologies I highly encourage you to incorporate into your lessons in the way of experiences are copyrighted for common use only. That truly means they want you to use them with your students in your classroom, but it might preclude me from spreading the news, which is a little mind-boggling, but okay, I get it. I'm not going to show any snapshots of the actual or demonstrations of the actual simulations here. But what I am showing you is a snapshot of what a task instruction and an artifact outline look like together. Now, the task instructions provide my students with a guide and clarity and clear expectations for what they should do and what they should be able to come out having learned or understood. And the artifact outline is basically the notes that they're taking, the place that they're recording their information. So this first example I have for you is about determining types of chemical bonds. Now, this activity is designed around an interactive tutorial that's available online, and it's animated. It's not quite a video, but it's not quite a student-controlled simulation either. The students just merely click through it. But what it does do is it overviews all three types of chemical bonding, ionic, covalent, and metallic, showing students in both imagery, dynamic imagery, and text how these bonds happen and the end result. And so what they're charged to do with this information as they move through it is document it and a type of note-taking. However, I've organized it for them so that they're looking for very specific features. They're looking for what type of atom is involved in each type of bonding, what the electrons are doing and how they're behaving while the bonding is occurring, and then finally, what are some specific examples that were provided. What this does at the end is allow students to look back on their notes, back on their experience, and very clearly compare and contrast the three types of bonding. In the next example I'm going to show you, it's much more what you might think of as a web quest style. And truly, it doesn't matter what we call any of these things. Remember, what matters is that the students are taking the learning in their own hands, they're seeking out the answers, they're trying to make understanding for themselves. In this activity, it's really an introduction to all types of chemical reactions and equations and basic chemical change. And it is a simulation where all the students do is drag a little dot. But dragging that dot passes a compound through an iridium catalyst that is just shown as a little silver box. And at the outside, at the end of it, comes out separated particles. I believe this is the decomposition of hydrazine into multiple pieces. And so students are documenting through that answers to a series of about 10 questions, but they are all observation based, and then a little bit of follow-up: what do you think and how do you interpret things like the subscripts that are S, L, and G based on what you see. And the fantastic thing about this simulation is that this animation is happening as the student controls it, so as fast as slower as they want. They could go forward or backward. But next to it, written, is the chemical equation. So we're sort of seeing the reaction happen versus the chemical equation on the right-hand side, really tying together the idea of those and how they complement each other and how we use one to describe what happens in the other. And the final one I brought for you today here, because I know eventually you'll come up against a wall and you won't be able to find something that is dynamic and video and simulation-esque. There are plenty of lessons that I have that way. This one is about types of intermolecular forces. My students need to learn about hydrogen bonding, dipole-dipole, London dispersion, and pretty much those are the big three. And this website provides sort of, it is, I would call it an interactive tutorial, where it's mostly made of text and sort of like a dynamic slideshow. Students do have to click through to the next slide, and this is probably a series of 7 to 10 slides, but on each of those slides there are animations. Students can't click through until the animations are done playing. And so in this activity, again, I'm asking students to take notes about what they learn, but in specific categories. So here they look for what types of molecules do that type of intermolecular forces, and how specifically does attraction happen, how does it affect the final properties, and again, some examples. So the main idea here when we look back as a group, or when students look back, is what they should be able to see no matter what type of intermolecular force we're ever talking about or looking for, is this feature of opposites attract, that you need some partial charge, you need some negative charge, and really how those come about is what differentiates each of the different types of forces. But it is a literacy-based activity. It does have those dynamic animations added in with it. And my students do take at least 20 minutes of a class period to sort through that information and really process it for themselves. And then, just in case anybody missed anything, and to highlight that overarching theme of opposites attract, we go over it at the end together. But students are in control. That's the idea here. So I know that the examples that I can show you here are pretty limited to my own experience, which is teaching chemistry. But I tried to select examples for you that really relied upon resources of different types to get you to see and understand that it truly doesn't matter what content you teach. If you know your content well, you can find a resource, and you could use your expertise to guide students through that resource to learn the core ideas they need to know. And if you can't find a resource, you absolutely can make your own activity. If you're really interested in doing just that, to add more active learning to your classroom and rely less on lecture, let me show you how in the Active Learning Action Plan. Check it out at www.labineverylesson.com/activeplan for more details. And I'll see you back here soon.